accession number 17986, Reel 1.
Mr. Mostyn, Reel 1, where were you born?
Please? I was born in Newton Willows.
Which year was this?
In 1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Newton Willows?
Yes, I went to Newton Willows Grammar School, and when I finished the grammar school, I started to work for the local council in the town hall in the Treasurer's Department. Then the war came, of course, and in 1940 I went to Wigan and volunteered for the Royal Air Force as a pilot. I was sent to RAF Padgate for aircrew selection board. I was classified pilot stroke observer and sent home with on reserve. They gave me a badge to wear to say that I was a RAF VR.
Why did you want to go into RAF aircrew?
Why? Well, really, two reasons. One was the publicity campaign. At the time, they wanted Spitfire pilots everywhere. And the other one, my father had been in the First World War, in the trenches, and I didn't want to go in the trenches.
And next? What happened next?
I then was called up to reported to Stratford-on-Avon for 1 week, where I was attested and posted to Scarborough for ITW.
What date approximately have we reached now?
We're in 1941.
Don't bother with your logbook, just go from memory. I
can't remember really the dates, but after 6 weeks, learning the usual things, engines, meteorology, theory of flight, navigation, all this sort of caper. We were being posted to Canada for our flying training. We boarded a ship in Gorick, which apparently was a German ship which had been commandeered. It had been in Liverpool, the port of Liverpool, when the war started and was commandeered, but subsequently bombed by the Germans and sunk in the Mersey and salvaged, painted with red lead paint all over, which was still wet when we got on it, and we set off in convoy for Canada. Unfortunately, the boat didn't make it. They broke down and was having trouble, so they had to put in at Reykjavik in Iceland. Which, of course, they didn't know what to do with us. I should think there were about a course of about 35 trainee aircrew. And had an interesting time. They took us to a place like Alafos, which was going to be an RAF station, but there was only one building up, which eventually would be going to become the NAFI. And we had to live in there. There was no running water except a stream that came straight off a glacier. And we were there for a month trying to get transport to Canada. Eventually, they put us on an armed merchant cruiser and took us across. We went straight across Canada to Calgary, where I flew Tiger Moths on what is now Calgary International Airport.
What was the flying training like in Canada?
The training was fine, but unfortunately, my instructor was a Canadian bush pilot, or former bush pilot. He was then a flying officer. He was about 6'6" and seemed to be about the same width as he was tall. He sat in the front seat of a Tiger Moth, and I couldn't see anything in front of him, and I wasn't getting on very well at all. The system was, if you didn't go solo, I think it was 12 hours, then you were washed out, and you had to become an observer, as it was in those days. And I wasn't getting very honoured all very well, and I decided rather than have a washout test, I would go and see the commander, the flight commander, and suggest that I went on an observer's course. The following morning, I went to the flight and asked to see the flight commander, and he said he was very busy. He'd see me as soon as he'd got everything sorted out. And when he'd got everything sorted out, he came to me and said, "I'm very sorry, but I haven't an instructor for you. Your instructor's gone on compassionate leave. His wife's had a child and he's got some compassionate leave. But I've got a replacement instructor coming from England. He won't arrive till late this afternoon, but if you come down to flight at 6 o'clock this evening, you can have your hour then." We had an hour flying. I went to the flight at 6 o'clock this evening to meet a sergeant pilot, instructor, come out from England, ex-Bath of Britain pilot, different again to flying off his Somerville as he was, and we went up and did a few circuits and bumps, and he said, "Right, that's it, back to the flight." And I went and switched off the engine. He said, "What did you do that for?" I said, "Well," he said, "we'd finished." And no, he said, "I'm getting out, you're going solo." And I went solo. And I went on like a house on fire with this sergeant. In so much, at the end of the course, we were inspected by Air Commodore Critchley, who was then in charge of Flying Training Command. And I was the star pupil on the course. But the unfortunate part about it, flying off as Somerville was back then, so I was his pupil, and the poor sergeant that had done all the work was at the back. He got no credit at all. I left there to go, for some reason or other, they must have thought I was fighter pilot material, and I was posted to Moose Jaw to fly Harvards. I flew Harvards for... 6 weeks, and had no problems at all with flying a Harvard. Only one incident happened of any interest while I was at Moose Jaw, and that towards the end of the course I was sent up for doing our solo aerobatics. And having done the usual standard aerobatics, the loop, the roll off the top, etc., etc., it was a beautiful day. There were about 5 tenths cumulus cloud, about 5,000 feet, and I was enjoying myself diving in and out of these clouds. And my hour was up. Could I find where I was? I was nowhere on. I found a grain elevator, found the name of the town or village that it was, but it wasn't on the map I had. And it was beginning to get a little bit dark, so I saw a large stubble field and landed the aeroplane, wheels down, in this stubble field. Taxied up to a farmhouse which was in the corner, asked where I was, and they told me. I rang Moose Jaw. They said, "Well, you'll have to stay overnight, and tomorrow morning we'll send two instructors down to get the aircraft out. You will have to go back in a wagon." No, I was very fortunate that the farmer had an attractive daughter who took me down to the village dance in the evening. But I was rather worried because I was sure I was going to be washed out for this, and I expected awful trouble when I got back, but it was never mentioned. Nobody mentioned it at all. It was as though it never happened. I think the main thing was I didn't damage the aeroplane. And I'd done everything right and made a proper force landing and all this sort of thing, and everybody was happy. We came back, had a fortnight's leave and came back to England, where originally went to Bournemouth for a week, and then from there I did a week at Watton, where we did flew a master. And then I was posted to a Hurricane OTU, Teeling, and this is in Scotland. I enjoyed flying Hurricanes very much. I liked the Hurricane. I thought it was a wonderful aeroplane, and I think my classification, then, of course, according to the logbook, was above average in air gunnery, which was very pleased. But in typical RAF fashion, at the end of the course, I'm posted to number 81 Fighter Squadron at Hornchurch. And when I got there, they were flying Spitfire 5s. And I'd never seen a Spitfire on the ground. I'd seen them in the air, obviously, and plenty of photographs, but I'd never actually seen a Spitfire on the ground. And I was posted as an operational pilot on Spitfires and never flown one. Raspberry, who was the commanding officer, said, right, there's the pilot's note, reads the pilot's notes and get some air experience on the type. It took me most of the hour, I think it was an hour, trying to get the aeroplane on the ground because it wouldn't. The approach speeds, according to pilot's notes, were the same for both aircraft. But if you came with a Hurricane, if you were coming at, it was 85 miles an hour. If you came at 95, it didn't make any difference. You just got the throttle and she went down. With a Spitfire, it didn't come down. It just floated. And it took me ages to get it down on the ground. But of course, I certainly learned that when it meant 85, it meant 85. It didn't mean 90 or 95. And then shortly I went on my first operational flight, which was shooting up shipping off the end of the pier at Ostend. There was a wing of Spitfires led by who was then Wing Commander Paddy Finucane. I don't know whether you've heard of him, have you? And I was, of course, number four, which means we flew low over South England to avoid any radar. So I was almost scraping the rooftops, not knowing really where all the controls were, so I hadn't time to be frightened. I was trying to decide what switch was which in the aeroplane, trying to remember them.
This is at Ostend?
At Ostend. I think I've since read the squadron diary, where it said that Sergeant Mostyn decided to... there were so many people shooting at the ship that he decided to attack a machine gun position at the end of the pier. Can't remember much about it myself, but that's what it said in the diary. And...
Was it at all frightening, this operation?
I hadn't time to be frightened. I didn't know the aeroplane well enough to be frightened. Now, my next...
This seems to have been the 14th of July 1942, according to your
logbook. Well, that was would be that. Now, the next exciting one, we were to escort six Bostons bomb Flushing. As the wing was to escort, and, of course, one squadron was close escort, which was 81 Squadron, which meant we formated, basically, on the Bostons, and which meant we got all the flak. I'd never seen, never flown in much flak before. As we approached Flushing, there was these black puffs all round, and then I saw one Boston hit and go down. A couple of parachutes came out of it. And I saw another one go down and didn't like it very much at all. And then there was a crash just like a electric light bulb being thrown against a wall, plop. And I thought, this is me, I'm the next one. And I was sure I was hit. My leg was hurting and my face, and I took off my glove and I was feeling my face for blood. I couldn't find any blood, and down on my leg I couldn't find anything, so I decided to say nothing about it. Anyway, we eventually got back home to Hornchurch, and as I opened the canopy to land, I noticed a big hole in the canopy, right through the canopy, between my head and the armour plating behind. And it would cause splinters of perspex that had thought I'd been hit with. Anyway, I had a damage report, a debriefing, what have you, and I reported the damage to the engineer officer and what have you. And he came into the crew room about half an hour later. He said, you were very lucky. I said, I know I was. That was very close to my head. Oh, he said, I'm not bothered about that. He said, I can repair that in 10 minutes. He said, have you seen the tail? I said, no. Well, he said, you better come and have a look at it. And underneath the tail plane, there was all about this big, straight through. And the fin, you could wobble the fin.
A hole about a foot across?
Yeah, gone right through. I didn't know that. And of course, I hadn't seen it. I landed normally. And I couldn't. It was underneath the tail. I'd got it down to look at it. But the engineering officer didn't think much to the canopy, so you can put a new canopy on in 10 minutes. Now, what was it?
That was the 1st of August, by the way.
Was it?
1942.
And my next really exciting one, I think it was... apparently there was to be a bombing raid on Le Havre. I think it was some anti-submarine pens or something, And 20 miles south was a Focke-Wulf 190 base. And the idea was, we as a wing were going a quarter of an hour before the bombing attack on Le Havre with the intention of getting the Focke-Wulf 190s off the ground, so that they would have to go down to refuel by the time the bombers arrived. We fluffed around over... we were taking off at lunchtime at 12 noon, and it was organised. It was going to be a long flight. It was kind of maximum endurance of a Spitfire, that we would have a late lunch when we got back, and that was ordered. Anyway, after kerfuffling around with the 190s... we're coming back. I was about 18,000 feet over, just kind of left the French coast, when the engine stops. I look down. It's a hell of a long way down. I'm very keen. I wasn't a good swimmer. I know I had all the gear, but I knew if I were going to float round off the French coast, I would probably be a prisoner of war for the duration. So I decided to glide as far as I could. And I stayed with the aeroplane, and I crossed the English coast near Folkestone at about 1,800 feet with a dead engine. I'd got to put it down quickly. I'll find somewhere to put it down, because it was coming down rapidly. And I saw a cornfield, a smallish cornfield, ripe. The corn was ready for harvest. I thought, that's it. I mean, that's going to slow me down nicely. And I crash-landed in the middle of this cornfield. As I kind of got out, and the nearest airfield was Hawkins, which the rest of the squadron landed out, because they all had to refuel because they were all out of fuel. And so I wanted to get in touch with Hawkins to tell them I was all right, or to tell Raspberry that I was all right. And we got out, and there was I met the farmer, who was a little bit annoyed about the damage to his cornfield ready for harvest. And I kind of, in those days, you lit a cigarette. And pointed the Spitfire was a little bit bent and this sort of thing. But he was a bit very annoyed, and had a 12-bore under his arm, and I wasn't very impressed when about 12 soldiers came running across the cornfield. See, having seen an aeroplane crash, of course they did, didn't they? And they ran across. They did far more damage to his corn than I did, really. But he couldn't shoot all those. And so they told me that they were... first of all, I said to them, look, I want a telephone to ring Hawkins. They said, well, we're attached to Hawkins. We're an anti-aircraft emplacement, and we have a direct line to the ops room at Hawkins. So I said, can we get back to your camp without going on the making any more mess of his corn than we've got to do? Oh, there, says, we can go up the lane, turn right at the crossroads. It's about a quarter of a mile up there. So this is what we did, and there was a lady on the corner. She called me fit to burn. Who said my parents weren't married and all this sort of thing. When one of these soldiers said, it's all right, Mrs. is one of ours. And she came around, put her arm around me, and she said, oh, you poor boy. I was a bastard 2 minutes before. Anyway, we got to, eventually got to their base, rang up, an ambulance came, picked me up, and I said, but, she said, I've got to take you to sick quarters. I said, why? She said, because that's my instructions. We've got to sick quarters. You've got to wait for the MO to say you're all right to leave. And where's the MO? They're out looking for you. Everybody's out looking for you. Anyway, I eventually got back to Hornchurch. Even that was a bit traumatic. The Raspberry said he'd send the station, the squadron magister, to pick me up. And then he rang back about 7 o'clock to say it was unserviceable, make my own way back. And I found somebody with the SE rescue lot with a Lysander. They flew me back in a Lysander. I don't think there was all. Then the rest of the time I was at Hornchurch was a fighter sweeps with Finucane, of course, who unfortunately was killed.
What was Finucane like?
Great fella. He was, honestly, a great fella.
Have you any particular memories of him?
If I may look at this. There's some reference to it in here.
But just go from memory, I think.
Well, I'm just saying it where it said somewhere. I think it was a bit in the local paper somewhere that I'd. Anyway, I just thought he was a great fighter pilot. He was a wonderful chap to get on with. He was the wing commander. I was a sergeant pilot, and there was no pulling rank or anything like that. He would come down to the crew room. Before every time he used to come down to 81 Squadron crew room, and we used to listen to a record. His favourite record was called Tangerine. And we used to play this every time before we went on a fighter sweep. And except the day that he died, he didn't. It was the first time we'd never had it. And, of course, that's one of the things we talked about. He should have come and listened to Tangerine. Well, another thing was rather amazing about him, he liked wing takeoffs. Hornchurch was a grass field. And he liked his 36 Spitfires to take off line abreast. Now, you probably know that when you take off and land, in our day, you have the canopy open. And the noise when 36 Spitfires opened their throttles for the takeoff, well, it was just unbelievable. But it was rather inspiring, I must admit. So I had great affection, memories of Paddy Finucane. Then we spent the time doing, the squadron moved to the satellite at Fairlop, where we did spend our time doing convoy patrols up the English Channel, looking after. And if you got down below about 2,000 feet, they opened fire on you. You know, it didn't make any difference whether you were escorting them. If you got near, they fired at you. That was the Navy. my next time was, shall I say, the next period We went up to Sutton Bridge as a squadron to train with the servicing commando. Now, we'd never heard of these. I don't know if you know much about the servicing commando. But they were tradesmen, all the usual tradesmen with engines, airframes, instruments, armourers, what have you. But they were also soldiers. They could fight. We didn't know what it was all about, but we trained with them. We would fly off and they would come back, and with their Sten guns on their back, they would rearm and refuel and be ready to fight off any enemy. This was all in training, of course. And we, of course, didn't realise at the time, but obviously it was for Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa. We went up to Wellingore in Lincoln to hand our Spitfires over, and we received tropical kit and went on leave.
Before you just take it any further, I notice you've put the 28th of August, you put beat up London. What exactly happened there?
I can't remember, really.
That low flying
over. Oh, yes, it'd be low flying. I think there was always a question of flying and through Tower Bridge or something like that. I don't say that we did that, but if 4 o'clock in the morning, it was quite possible, you know, before anybody could see you, if it was light. But of course, we were, obviously, our role was defensive City of London originally as Hornchurch, and we were always very well received in London. I went up the West End. It was very rarely that you have to buy your own drinks. Anyway, we're going back to Operation Torch. We eventually got onto a large convoy in Gourock in a small boat with the four squadrons of pilots on it. And we set off at 6 knots, and it took ages. It was an enormous convoy, which was obviously to invade North Africa. One night, in the middle of the night, we broke away from the convoy and ran into Jib. And we landed soon after midnight, and we were told, get off the boat as quickly as possible into trucks. They wanted to take us round to the far side of the rock so we could not be seen by the duty spy who sat on the German consulate at Algeciras and watch what was going on. They didn't want them to realise something unusual was happening. The next day we were briefed in a cinema around the other side by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who told us that we were going to invade North Africa on three fronts: Oran, Casablanca and Algiers. Because we'd sunk the French, or the RAF had sunk the French, or the, sorry, the Royal Navy had sunk the French fleet, wherever it was, at Toulouse or somewhere, that the Vichy French, who controlled North Africa, would take far more kindly to Americans than they would to British.